The bartender was badly hurt.
Tim?
She asked, because she thought knowing the details might make her understand that this had really happened. Helen shook her head. I don't know his name. Claire looked up at the house. She was feeling disembodied again, drifting in and out of the wake of Paul's absence. And then she thought of the snake man and snapped back into the present. Claire asked the cop,
There was more than one burglar?
There were three African-American males, medium builds, mid-twenties. They were all wearing masks and gloves. Helen had never had much faith in police officers.
With that description, I'm sure you'll find them in no time.
Mother,
Claire tried, because this wasn't helping. They were in a silver late-model four-door. The cop gripped the baton handle on her belt, likely because she longed to use it. We've got a statewide bolo on the vehicle.
Young lady, to me a bolo is a garish string tie.
Helen was in full librarian mode again, taking out all the angst that she couldn't direct toward Claire.
Could you trouble yourself to speak English?
Jenny provided,
Be on the lookout, am I right?
She smiled sweetly at the cop.
I have a colored television in my sitting room.
Claire said, I can't sit in the driveway like this. Helen grabbed her arm and helped her stand.
What would Paul do if he were here?
He would take charge.
Claire couldn't do that. She could barely keep her legs underneath her.
Did the burglars take anything? The cop said, We don't think so, ma'am, but we need you to walk through with the detectives and check. She pointed toward a group of men standing by the mudroom door. They were all wearing Columbo trench coats. One of them even had a cigar clenched between his teeth. They'll give you a checklist to generate an inventory. You'll need a thorough report for your insurance company.
Claire felt so overwhelmed that she almost laughed. The woman might as well have asked her to catalog the Smithsonian.
I've got people coming. I need to make sure the tables are set up. The caterer...
Ma'am, the cop interrupted. We can't let anyone into the house until the scene is cleared.
Claire put her fist to her mouth so she wouldn't tell the cop to stop calling her fucking ma'am.
Ma'am, the cop said. Claire dropped her fist. There was a car stopped at the bottom of the driveway. Gray Mercedes, headlights on. Yellow funeral flag hanging out of the window. Another Mercedes slowed to a stop behind it. The funeral procession had finally caught up.
What was she going to do?
Falling to the ground again seemed like the simplest solution. And then what? The ambulance? The hospital? The sedatives? Eventually, she would be sent home. Eventually, she would find herself standing in this same place again, with the detectives and the inventory and insurance and the bullshit.
This was all Paul's fault.
He should be here. He should be taking care of all of this. That was his job. Claire Scott was furious at her dead husband for not being there to solve her problems.
Honey, Helen asked.
I'm okay.
Claire had realized a long time ago that if you lie with enough conviction, you can usually fool yourself. All that she had to do now was generate a to-do list. That's what Paul would have done. He had always said there was nothing that a list couldn't solve. Conquer the details, and you conquer the problem.
I'll go walk the detectives through the house. We'll need to cancel the wake.
She turned to the limo driver, who'd been discreetly standing to the side.
Can you take my grandmother back to the home, please?
She told the cop. Please cancel the ambulance. I'm fine. There are over 100 people on their way here. Unless you want them coming into the house, you need to post someone at the bottom of the driveway to stop them.
Will do.
The cop seemed happy to get away from them. She practically ran down the driveway. Claire felt some of her bluster dissipate. She looked at her mother.
I'm not sure I can do this.
You're already doing it.
Helen looped her hand through Claire's arm and walked with her toward the men in trench coats.
Did you hurt your head when you fainted?
No. Claire felt the back of her head. The bruises from the alley were still tender. Another lump wouldn't make much of a difference.
Have I ever fainted before?
Not that I know of. You should try to do it in the grass next time. I thought you'd cracked open your noggin. She squeezed her mother's arm.
You don't have to stay here.
I'm not leaving until I know you're all right. Claire pressed together her lips. There had been a time when her mother had been incapable of being present for anything.
Listen, I know how you feel about the police, but you need to cool it.
Huckleberries, Helen muttered, her word for incompetent policeman. You know, it's occurred to me that I'm just about the only person in our family who hasn't gone to prison.
Jail, Mother. Prison is for after you're convicted.
Thank God I didn't use the wrong word with my book club.
Mrs. Scott.
One of the trench-coated men walked over with his badge in his hand. He reeked of cigar smoke because it wasn't enough of a cliché to wear a trench coat.
I'm Captain Mayhew, Dunwoody Police Department.
Captain? Claire asked.
The man she'd talked to after Paul's murder was only a detective. Was a burglary more important than a murder? Or were murders so common in the city of Atlanta that they relegated them to detectives?
I'm real sorry for your loss.
Mayhew dropped the badge into his coat pocket. His mustache was bushy and untrimmed, hairs climbed down from his nostrils.
The congressman asked me to handle this personally.
Claire knew who the congressman was. Johnny Jackson had been Paul's benefactor almost from the start, awarding him government contracts that should have gone to more experienced architects. The man's early investment had been rewarded over the years. Every time Quinn and Scott was given a new government job, Paul's personal Amex bill was riddled with charges for chartered planes he never flew in and five-star hotels where he never stayed. She took a deep breath and asked,
I'm sorry, Captain. I'm feeling a bit discombobulated. Can you please start from the beginning and tell me what happened?
Yeah. I can imagine with the funeral and all, this is the last thing you want to be dealing with right now. Like I said, my condolences.
Mayhew took his own deep breath, his far more raspy.
We've got a nutshell, but we're still filling in some blanks. You're not the first person in the county to have this kind of thing happen. We suspect it's a gang of young males who read the obituaries, find out when the funerals are, then Google Earth the house and figure out whether it's worth robbing.
Good Lord, Helen said. That really is beyond the pale.
Mayhew seemed just as outraged.
We think the burglars only had a minute or so before the catering van pulled up. They saw the broken glass from the side door.
He pointed to the glass, which was still scattered on the bluestone steps.
The bartender went inside. Probably not the best idea. He took a beating, but he managed to stop the gang from cleaning you out.
Claire looked up at the house again. Paul had been drawing variations of the plan since architectural school. The only thing that changed was the amount of money they could spend. Neither one of them had grown up rich. Claire's father had been a college professor. Paul's parents had owned a farm. He loved having money because it made him feel secure. Claire loved having it because once you paid for something, no one could ever take it away from you. Had she not paid enough for Paul? Had she not worked enough, loved enough, been enough? Is that why she had lost him?
Mrs. Scott.
I'm sorry.
Claire didn't know why she kept apologizing. Paul would have cared more about this. He would have been outraged by the violation. Their window broken, burglars rifling their belongings. One of their employees attacked. Claire would have been right beside him, just as outraged, but without Paul, she could barely force herself to go through the motions. Helen asked,
Can you tell us if the bartender is okay? Tim, was it?
Yeah, Tim. Mayhew nodded and shrugged at the same time. Most of the wounds are superficial. They took him to the hospital to stitch him up.
Clara felt some of the horror penetrate. Tim had been bartending for them for years. He had a son with autism and an ex-wife he was trying to win back, and now he was being stitched up at the hospital because of something horrible that had happened inside her home.
Helen asked, "But you still need Claire to go through the house to see if the burglars took anything?"
"Yes, eventually. I know this is really bad timing, but what we need from Mrs. Scott right now is to know where the setup is for the security cameras."
He pointed to the black globe on the corner of the house.
"We're pretty sure that one got them coming and going."
"I'll take you to it." Claire didn't move. They were all staring at her, waiting. There was something else she needed to do. Lots of something else's. The list. She felt her brain flip back on like a light switch. Claire turned to her mother.
"Can you ask the caterers to donate the food to the shelter and let Tim know we'll take care of the hospital bill? I'm sure it's covered under our homeowner's policy."
Where was the paperwork? Claire didn't even know who their agent was.
"Mrs. Scott?"
There was another man standing beside Captain Mayhew. He was a few inches taller and dressed slightly better than the rest of the group. His trench coat was nicer, his suit was better tailored, and his face was clean-shaven. His easy manner should have put Claire at ease, but there was something about him that felt deeply unsettling, not least of all because he was sporting a nasty-looking black eye. The man indicated his bruised eye with a chuckle.
"The wife doesn't like it when I talk back."
Helen said, "Domestic violence is so funny." She noted Claire's wary expression. "I'll be in the kitchen if you need me."
The black-eyed man tried again. "Sorry, Mrs. Scott. My name is Fred Nolan. Maybe we can talk while you take us to the guts of the security system."
He was standing close enough that Claire felt the need to step back. "This way." She started walking toward the garage.
"Hold up."
Nolan put his hand on her arm, his thumb pressed against the soft underside of her wrist.
"The control board for the security system is in the garage?"
Claire had never taken such an instant, visceral dislike to another human being. She looked down at his hand, willing the skin to freeze to the bone. Nolan got the message. He released her arm. "As I said, it's this way." Claire suppressed a shudder as she continued walking. Mayhew walked beside her. Nolan followed closely at her heels. Too close. The man wasn't just unsettling, he was creepy. He looked more like a mobster than a cop, but he was obviously good at his job. Claire hadn't done anything criminal, at least, not lately. But he'd managed to make her feel guilty anyway.
Nolan said, "Usually all the security stuff is in the main part of the house."
"Fascinating," Claire mumbled. She could feel a headache working into her temples. Maybe the burglary was a godsend. Instead of spending the next 4 hours entertaining Paul's mourners, she would spend half an hour with this asshole before she kicked them all out of the house and took a handful of Valium to bed. For complicated reasons, Paul had tried to explain, all the security mainframes were in the garage, which was a two-story, detached structure built in the same style as the house. Paul's office on the top floor had a kitchenette, 2 walk-in closets, and a full bathroom. They had laughed about the space being nicer than a hotel if she ever kicked him out of the house.
"Mrs. Scott, do you mind my asking why the alarm wasn't on?"
This was from Mayhew. He had taken out a notebook and pen. His shoulders were hunched, as if someone had asked him to mimic a character from a Raymond Chandler novel. Claire said, "I always leave the alarm off for the caterers. The gate was closed." His mustache twitched.
"The caterers have the front gate code?"
"And a key to the main house."
"Anyone else have a key?"
The question struck her as odd, or Maybe she was annoyed by the way Fred Nolan was still breathing down her neck. Why would the burglars break the glass in the door if they had a key?
Mayhew looked up from his notebook. It's just a routine question. We'll need to talk to anybody who had access to the house.
Claire felt a tickling sensation at the base of her throat. She was starting to feel overwhelmed again. This was the sort of thing Paul would know. She tried. The house cleaners, our handyman, Paul's assistant, his partner, my mother. I can look for names and numbers.
Your mom, Nolan said. She's quite the pistol.
Claire pressed the code into the keypad beside the four-bay garage. The heavy wooden door slid silently up its tracks. She watched the men's eyes take in the diamond plate wainscoting and the matching storage cabinets. The floor was a racetrack white and black rubber tile. There was a bracket for everything, hand tools, extension cords, tennis rackets, golf clubs, basketball, sunglasses, shoes. Paul's custom workbench took up one side of the room. He had a charging station, a mini fridge, a flat panel TV, and an air conditioner for hot summer days. Then, of course, there was Claire's BMW and Paul's Porsche Carrera and Tesla Model S.
Holy shit.
Nolan's tone was reverential. Claire had seen men get harder over Paul's garage than they ever got over a woman.
It's through here.
Claire entered the four-digit code into another keypad and led them downstairs to the basement. She had loved that Paul loved his garage. He spent hours in here working on his models. Claire had teased him that the only reason he constructed them at home instead of at work was because here he got to clean up after himself.
Kind of a neat freak, Nolan said, as if reading her mind.
I got lucky, Claire told him.
Paul's mild, obsessive-compulsive disorder had never stopped their lives or made him do odd things like touch a doorknob 12 times. Actually, his compulsions manifested themselves in acts that any wife could appreciate. Putting down the toilet seat, folding all the clothes, cleaning up the kitchen every night. At the bottom of the stairs, Claire entered another four-digit code into the keypad on the door. The lock clicked open.
Mayhew said, "Never seen a basement under a garage like this."
Nolan said,
"Kind of Silence of the Lambsy."
Claire flipped on the lights and the small, concrete room came into stark relief. Paul had designed the space to double as a tornado shelter. Metal shelves held food and supplies. There was a small TV, a weather radio, a couple of camping cots, and plenty of junk food, because Claire had told Paul that in the event of the apocalypse, she was going to need lots of chocolate and Cheetos. She was glad she still had on her coat. The temperature was kept low because of all the computers. Everything was controlled from inside this room, not just the security cameras, but all the audiovisual systems, the automation for the blinds and fixtures, and whatever else made the house run like magic. There were banks of components with flashing lights and a small desk with four flat-screen monitors mounted on articulating stands. Nolan asked,
"Does your husband secretly work for the NSA?"
Claire was tired of his questions, which were made even more grating by his flat, Midwestern accent. The most expedient thing would be to just give them what they wanted so they would go away. She opened a desk drawer and found the laminated checklist that explained how to work the security cameras. Paul had tried to walk her through the steps, but Claire's eyes had glazed over, and she'd worried she was going to have a seizure. She tapped the computer keyboard and entered the access code to the system.
"Lots of passwords to remember."
Nolan was standing too close again. Claire slid away from Nolan. She handed Mayhew the directions.
"You'll have to take it from here."
Nolan asked,
"Are all of your houses like this?"
"We only have one house."
"Only,"
Nolan laughed. Claire had reached her limit. My husband is dead, and now my house has been broken into. Is there something you find funny about this situation?
Whoa. Nolan held up his hands like she'd tried to scratch out his eyes. No offense, lady.
Mayhew's mustache twitched again.
Hard to offend someone if you keep your fucking mouth shut.
Claire gave Nolan a look before turning away from him. She knew how to shut down a man. He didn't leave, but he took a few steps back to let her know the message had been received. She watched the monitors as Mayhew followed Paul's checklist. The views were split so that each screen showed 4 different aspects from 16 different cameras. Every entrance, every bank of windows, the pool area, and several sections of the driveway were monitored. Claire could see that the caterers were in the motor court turning around their truck. Helen's silver Ford was parked on the other side of the garage. She was talking to one of the detectives outside the mudroom door. Her hands were on her hips. Claire was glad there was no sound. Mayhew flipped through the pages of his notebook.
Okay, we've got a basic time frame for the break-in based on when the caterers called 911.
He pecked at some keys, and Helen disappeared from the monitor. The catering van went from making a sharp turn to pulling into the motor court. Mayhew skipped back the footage until he found what he wanted. 3 individuals at the bottom of the driveway. They were far enough away to be indistinct, just dark, menacing blurs making their way toward the house. Claire felt every hair on the back of her neck rise up. This was actually something that had taken place at her home. She noted the time on the video. While the burglars were passing the parking pad in front of the house, Claire had been standing by the small, non-denominational chapel in the cemetery, wondering why she hadn't died in that alley with her husband.
"Here we go," Mayhew said.
Claire felt a sharp pain in her chest as the blurs turned into men. Seeing it made it real, something she had to deal with. It was just as she had been told. 3 African-American males in ski masks and gloves jogged up the driveway. They were all dressed in black. Their heads scanned left and right in a coordinated pattern. One of them held a crowbar in his hand. Another had a gun. Nolan said,
"Looks pretty professional to me."
Mayhew agreed.
"This ain't their first rodeo."
Claire studied the men walking so confidently toward her mudroom door. Paul had ordered all the doors and windows from Belgium. They were solid mahogany with 4-point locks that were easily bypassed when a crowbar smashed the leaded glass and one of the burglars stuck his arm through the window and turned the thumb latch. Her mouth went dry. She felt tears come into her eyes. This was her mudroom. This was her door, the same door she used countless times every day. The same door Paul came through when he got home from work. Used to come through. She said, "I'll be upstairs if you need me." Claire walked up the stairs. She wiped her eyes. Her mouth opened. She forced herself to draw in breath, to let it go, to fight the hysteria living in the pit of her stomach. Paul's stairs. Paul's workbench. Paul's cars. She went through the garage. She kept going to the stairs in the back and climbed them as quickly as her heels would allow. She didn't realize where she was going until she found herself standing in the middle of Paul's office. There was the couch he napped on. There was the chair he sat in to read or watch TV. There was the painting she'd given him for their 3rd wedding anniversary. There was his drafting table. There was his desk, which he designed so that no cords were hanging down. The blotter was pristine. The outbox held neatly stacked papers with Paul's angular handwriting. There was his computer. There was his pencil set. There was a framed photograph of Claire from more years ago than she could count. Paul had taken it with a Nikon that had belonged to his mother. Claire picked up the picture. They were at a football game. Paul's jacket was wrapped around her shoulders. She could recall thinking how warm it felt. How reassuring. The camera had captured her laughing, mouth open, head tilted back. Ecstatically, irrevocably happy. They'd both gone to Auburn University in Alabama, Paul because it had one of the top architectural programs in the country, Claire because it was far enough away from home to be meaningful. That she ended up with a boy who had grown up less than 20 miles from her childhood home was just further proof that no matter how far you ran, you always ended up back where you started. Paul had been a breath of fresh air compared to the other boys Claire dated in college. He was so sure of himself, so sure of what he wanted to do and where he was going. His undergrad had been paid by a full-ride scholarship, and graduate school was taken care of by the money he inherited when his parents died. Between a small life insurance policy, proceeds from the sale of the farm, and the out-of-court settlement from the trucking company that had owned the 18-wheeler that killed the Scotts, there was more than enough money for tuition and living expenses. Still, Paul had worked the entire time he was in school. He had grown up on a working farm where he was expected to do chores at the crack of dawn. In 9th grade, he'd won a scholarship to a military boarding school in southeast Alabama. Between the two home lives, routine had been drilled into his system. He was incapable of being idle. One of his jobs during college was at Tiger Rags, a university bookstore. The other was as a tutor in the math lab. Claire was an art history major. She had never been good at math, or at least she'd never tried to be, which was the same thing. She could vividly remember the first time she'd sat down with Paul and gone over one of her assignments.
"Everyone knows you're beautiful," he told her, "but no one knows that you're clever."
Clever. Anybody could be smart. It took a special somebody to be clever. Claire returned the photograph to its spot. She sat down at Paul's desk. She rested her arms where his arms used to rest. She closed her eyes and tried to find a trace of his scent. She took a deep breath until her lungs ached. Then, slowly sighed it out. She was almost 40 years old. She didn't have any children. Her husband was dead. Her best friends were probably drinking margaritas at the bar down the street and gossiping about how washed out she had looked at the funeral. Claire shook her head. She had the rest of her life to think about how lonely she was. What she needed to do right now was get through today, or at least the next hour. She picked up the telephone and dialed Adam Quinn's cell phone number. Paul had known Adam longer than he'd known Claire. They'd been dorm mates their first year at Auburn. They'd gotten their architectural degrees together. Adam had been best man at their wedding. More importantly, Adam and Paul tended to use the same people to manage their lives. He picked up on the first ring.
"Claire, are you all right?"
"I'm fine," she told him, but only now that she had something concrete to do did she feel that way. "Listen, I'm sorry to bother you, but do you know who our insurance agent is?"
"Oh, yeah, okay."
He sounded confused, probably because this was the last question he expected from Claire on the day of her husband's funeral. "Her name is Pia Lorit." He spelled the last name.
"I can text you her info."
"I don't have a cell phone," Claire realized. "The snake man took it. I mean, the guy who..."
"I'll email it to you."
Claire was about to tell him she couldn't access her email either, but then she remembered her iPad. It was an older model. Paul kept threatening to replace it with a laptop, and she kept saying it was fine, and now she would probably pack it up to take with her in 30-odd years when she went into a nursing home.
"Claire?"
Adam's voice was muffled. She gathered He was walking into another room. How many phone calls had there been between them where Adam had gone into another room? Half a dozen, maybe. So meaningless. So stupid. He said,
"Listen, I'm really sorry about this."
"Thank you." She felt tearful again, and she hated herself for it because Adam was the last person she should be tearful with.
"I want you to know if you need anything."
His voice trailed off. She heard a scratching sound and guessed he was rubbing his fingers along his face. Adam was one of those men who had a perpetual 5 o'clock shadow, even right after he'd shaved. Claire had never found hairy men particularly attractive, but she'd still managed to sleep with Adam anyway. She couldn't even console herself by saying it had happened a long time ago.
"Claire?"
"I'm here."
"I'm sorry to bring this up, but Paul should have a file on his computer for work in progress. Can you email it to me? I hate to ask, but we've got a really important presentation first thing Monday morning, and it would take hours to duplicate Paul's work."
"It's fine, I understand." She reached under Paul's desk and pulled out the keyboard. "I'll send it from his email."
"You've got his password."
"Yes. He trusted me."
Claire was conscious that she and Adam both knew he shouldn't have. What a stupid, pointless mistake.
She said, "You'll have it in a few minutes."
Claire hung up the phone. She thought about the hours she had spent with Adam Quinn, hours she should have spent with her husband, hours she would kill to have back now. There was no going back. She had to keep moving forward.
Paul's iMac desktop was a blank field of blue with the dock at the bottom. Beside the icons listing Paul's applications were three folders: work, personal, house. She clicked house and quickly found the January to-do list. She also saw a file titled Insurance that contained not just the name of their insurance agent, but a PDF with descriptions, photographs, and serial numbers of everything in the house. Claire sent all 508 pages to the printer. Next, she opened the work folder. This was far more complicated and confusing. There was no work-in-progress folder, just a long list of files with numbers instead of names. Claire assumed these were project numbers, but she couldn't be certain. She clicked on the date field to list them chronologically. There were 15 recent files he'd been working on in the last 2 weeks. The last one had been opened the night before Paul died. Claire clicked on the file. She expected to find a schematic or scope of work, but all that happened was the little iMovie icon on the dock started bouncing.
"Oh," she said, because at first she didn't understand what she was seeing.
And then she smiled for the first time since the snake man had told them not to move. Paul had been looking at porn on his computer. Not just any porn. Kinky porn. A young woman in a leather bustier was chained to a concrete block wall. She wore a studded dog collar. Her arms and legs were spread-eagled, giving her crotchless leather panties a workout. She was making squeaky, fearful noises that sounded more 1970s horny than present-day scared. Claire shot a guilty glance at the open doorway to Paul's office. She muted the sound, but let the movie play. The woman was in a filthy room, which made it all the more shocking that Paul was interested. She was obviously young, but not alarmingly so. Her brunette hair was cut in a chic pixie. Heavy mascara ringed her eyes. Bright red lipstick made her lips seem bigger than they were. Her breasts were small, but she had fantastic legs. Paul had always liked Claire's legs, even when she had on the ankle monitor. Actually, he'd especially loved the ankle monitor, which was the kinkiest thing she'd ever gotten out of him until he'd turned inexplicably rough with her in the alley. And now, of course, because this movie was pretty out there. Suddenly, a man's head filled the screen. He was wearing a leather ski mask with open zippers at the mouth and eyes. He smiled into the camera. There was something disturbing about the way his red lips showed against the metal teeth of the zipper. Though Claire doubted, Paul had been looking at the man. The focus blurred, then sharpened. The smile disappeared. And then the man started walking toward the girl. Claire saw his erect penis jutting out from his tight leather briefs. There was a machete in his hand. The long blade glinted in the overhead light. The man stopped a few feet away from the girl. The machete arced into the air. Claire gasped. The machete came down on the woman's neck. Claire gasped again. The man wrenched out the blade. Blood sprayed everywhere, onto the walls, onto the man, onto the camera. Claire leaned forward, unable to look away. Was this real? The woman's body convulsed, arms and legs pulling at the chains, head jerking. Blood poured down her chest, pooled at her feet. The man started fucking her.
Mrs. Scott?
Claire jumped back so hard that the chair slammed into the wall.
Are you up there?
Fred Nolan was walking up the stairs. Claire banged on the keyboard, blindly searching for a way to stop the movie.
Hello?
Nolan's footsteps were getting closer.
Mrs. Scott?
She held down the control button and furiously tapped on the cue to quit the program. Error messages started popping up. Claire grabbed the mouse and clicked each one closed. The rainbow wheel started to spin.
Shit,
she hissed.
Mrs. Scott?
Fred Nolan was standing in the open doorway.
Something wrong?
Claire looked back at the computer. Sweet Jesus. The desktop was blank again. She willed her voice not to shake.
What is it?
Just wanted to say that I'm sorry about before.
Claire nodded. She didn't trust herself to speak. Nolan let his gaze travel around the room.
Nice office.
She tried not to blink because every time her eyes closed, she saw the woman, the man, the blood.
Anyway,
he tucked his hands into his pockets.
I wanted you to know that I talked to Detective Raymond about your husband's case.
She had to clear her throat a few times before she forced out.
What?
Detective Raymond with the Atlanta police. You spoke to him the night your husband was murdered?
She held her breath, trying to calm it.
Yes.
I want you to know that we looked at all possible connections, and there doesn't seem to be one between what happened to your husband and what happened today.
Claire nodded. She felt a sharp jab of pain in her jaw from clenching her teeth. Nolan let his eyes slowly take another tour of the office.
Your husband was a tidy guy.
Claire didn't respond.
Kind of a control freak?
She shrugged. Though Paul had never tried to control her. Except when he jammed her face into that brick wall in the alley. Nolan indicated the digital lock on the door.
That's some pretty serious security.
She echoed the words that Paul had often told her.
Doesn't really matter if you don't set the alarm.
Nolan smiled his deeply unsettling smile. He wasn't standing over her, but he might as well have been.
We'll need to send a crew up here anyway.
She felt her heart stop. The computer. The files. The movie.
That's not necessary.
Better safe than sorry.
Claire tried to think of a good excuse to contradict him.
Did the security camera show the men breaking into the garage?
You can never be too sure.
She summoned a weak copy of her mother's librarian voice.
I would think 16 cameras would make you as sure as possible.
Nolan shrugged. He was smiling at her again.
Not to mention $500,000 worth of automobiles that are still parked in the garage.
He kept smiling, and Claire realized that she was talking too much. Her hands were sweating. She gripped the arms of the chair. Nolan asked,
"Something up here you don't want us to see?"
Claire forced herself not to look at the computer. Instead, she looked at his lips and tried not to think about the red, wet lips behind the zippered mask. He said,
"I'm curious, Mrs. Scott, did your husband say anything to you before he was murdered?"
She remembered the alley, the rough texture of the brick, the burn of skin being scraped from her cheek. Was Paul suddenly into that kind of thing? Was that why he had this movie on his computer?
Mrs. Scott, Nolan mistook her silence for embarrassment. Don't worry. Detective Raymond told me why you and your husband were in the alley. No judgment here. I'm just curious about what your husband said.
She cleared her throat again. He promised me he wasn't going to die.
Anything else?
I already told all of this to Detective Raymond.
Yeah, but that was a few days ago. Sometimes it takes some perspective to jog your memory.
He pressed a little harder.
Sleep usually does it. I've dealt with a lot of victims of violent crime. There's this adrenaline rush that gets them through the hard parts, and then they have to tell their story to old gumshoes like me. And then they go home and they're alone, and they start to crash because the adrenaline's gone, and there's no forward momentum, and they fall into a heavy sleep. And then, suddenly, they wake up in a sweat because they remembered something.
Claire swallowed again. He was perfectly describing her first night alone. But the only revelation that had come when she'd woken up with the sheets soaked in sweat was that Paul was not there to comfort her. Comfort. How could the man who looked at such vile filth possibly be the same gentle man who had comforted her for 18 years?
So,
Nolan said,
did you remember anything? Doesn't have to seem useful, just a stray comment he might have made, something unusual that he did, before or after the attack. Anything you can think of? Maybe not even something he said, but his demeanor.
Claire's hand went to her thigh. She could almost feel the missing streaks of skin where Paul had raked his fingers up her leg. He'd never marked her like that before. Had he wanted to? Had he been fighting the impulse all those years?
General demeanor, Nolan prompted. Anything he said.
He was shocked. We were both shocked. Claire clasped her hands together on the desk so that she wouldn't start wringing them. It's called Masters of the Universe Complex. She sounded like Paul, and in fact the phrase had come from her husband. It's where people think that status and money insulate them against tragedy.
Do you think that's true? Nolan asked. Seems like you've seen more tragedy than most.
That's a keen bit of detective work on your part. Claire forced herself to stay in the present. Are you a detective because when I met you in the driveway, you didn't give your title or show me your credentials?
You're right.
He didn't volunteer the information, so she said, I'd like to see your identification. Nolan was apparently unflappable. He reached into his coat pocket as he walked toward her. His wallet was a cheap bifold. Instead of a detective shield, there were two laminated cards behind plastic sleeves. Everything on the top card was in gold ink. The words, Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Blind Lady Justice, and the Bald Eagle. The bottom card was in blue ink and showed Fred Nolan's color photograph, his name, and revealed that he was a special agent from the Atlanta field office on West Peachtree. The FBI. What was the FBI doing here? She thought about the file on Paul's computer. Had the FBI tracked the download? Was Fred Nolan here because Paul had stumbled across something he shouldn't have? What Claire had seen could not be real. It was a made-up movie designed to appeal to a sick fetish. A sick fetish that, apparently, her husband had either stumbled across by mistake or kept hidden from her for the last 18 years. Satisfied? Nolan was still holding out his wallet. He was still smiling. He was still acting like this was a casual conversation. Claire looked at the credentials again. Nolan had fewer gray hairs in the photograph. Does the FBI routinely investigate foiled burglaries?
I've been doing this job long enough to know that nothing's routine.
He flipped the wallet closed.
The gang who robbed your house crossed county lines. We're helping coordinate between the police forces.
Isn't that the job of the Georgia Bureau of Investigation?
Well, you're certainly up on your law enforcement hierarchy.
Claire had to put a stop to this before she gave everything away. It just occurred to me that you never answered my questions, Agent Nolan, so maybe I should stop answering yours. Nolan chuckled.
I forgot. You've had experience with the justice system.
I'd like you to leave now.
Sure.
He indicated the door.
Open or closed?
When she didn't answer, he closed the door behind him anyway. Claire ran to the bathroom and threw up. Chapter 4
Lydia tried to concentrate on the road as she drove her daughter to an away game. She had lasted 24 hours before the full impact of Paul Scott's death hit her. The hangover from her ensuing breakdown was breathtakingly awful. All day she'd felt weepy and exhausted. Her head throbbed with every heartbeat. The coffee she'd gulped down to stave off the headache had made her fidgety. She hated the feeling of being punched drunk, and she hated it even more that her first thought when she opened her eyes this morning was that a bump of coke would even her out. She wasn't going to give up 17.5 years of sobriety for that asshole. She would throw herself off a bridge before she did something so stupid. But that didn't stop her from hating herself or even thinking of using. And it didn't stop her from crying like a baby last night. She had wept in Rick's arms for over an hour. He'd been so sweet to her, stroking her hair and telling her that she had every right to be upset. Instead of making her talk it out or driving her to a meeting, he'd put on John Coltrane and fried some chicken. The chicken was good. The company was better. They had started arguing about which was the best Coltrane solo, crescent or blue and green. And right in the middle of it, Dee came out of her room and gave Lydia the greatest gift a teenage daughter can ever give her mother. She had agreed with her. The cordiality had been short-lived. Dee was currently slumped in the minivan's passenger seat in what Lydia thought of as her phone posture, automobile. Her sneakers were on the dashboard, her elbows and forearms were flat to the seat like a kangaroo's feet. She held her iPhone 2 inches from her nose. The seatbelt would probably decapitate her if they were in an accident.
OMG, Dee would text as they waited for the ambulance. Decapped in car acts.
Lydia thought about all those times her own mother had told her to stand up straight, stop slouching, hold the book away from her face,
moisturize, wear a bra to bed, always suck in her stomach, and never hitchhike, and she wanted to slap herself for not following every single stupid piece of advice that had ever come out of the woman's mouth.
Too late for that now.
Rain started to spit onto the windshield. Lydia turned on the wipers. The rubber part of the blade skittered across the glass. Rick had told her last week to come by the station and get the wiper blades changed. He'd said the weather was looking bad, and Lydia had laughed because no one could predict the weather. Metal scraped glass as the shredded rubber flopped in the wind. Dee groaned.
Why didn't you get Rick to change those?
He said he was too busy. Dee gave her a sideways glance. Lydia turned up the radio, which is how she used to fix strange car noises before she dated a mechanic. She shifted in the seat, trying to get comfortable. The seat belt insistently pushed against her gut. The plump rolls of fat reminded her of a popped can of biscuits. This morning, Rick had gently suggested that she might want to go to a meeting. Lydia had agreed this was a good idea, but she'd ended up going to Waffle House instead. She told herself that she wasn't ready to share what she was feeling because she hadn't had time to process Paul Scott's death. And then she reminded herself that one of her more unsung talents was that she was really, really good at denial. Maintaining a $300-a-day Coke habit took a certain level of self-delusion. Then there was the short-sighted conviction that she was never to blame for the consequences of her own actions. The addict's credo? It's always somebody else's fault. For a while, Paul Scott had been that fault for Lydia. Her touchstone. Her mantra. If only Paul hadn't prefixed every excuse. And then Dee had come along, and Lydia had righted her life, and she'd met Rick. And Paul Scott had gotten shoved into the back of her mind the same way she had pushed back all the awful things that had happened during what she thought of as the bad years. Like the many times she'd found herself in county lockup, or the time she'd woken up with two skeevy guys in a Motel 8 and convinced herself that trading sex for drugs wasn't the same as doing it for money. At the Waffle House this morning, she'd almost ignored Rick's call on her cell phone. He had asked,
"You feel like using?"
"No," she'd told him, because by then the desire had been stifled by a tall stack of waffles.
"I feel like I want to dig up Paul's body and kill him all over again."
The last time Lydia had seen Paul Scott, she was practically crawling out of her skin from withdrawal. They were in his stupid Miata that he cleaned every weekend with cloth diapers and a toothbrush. It was dark outside, almost midnight. Hall & Oates were playing on the radio, Private Eyes. Paul was singing along. His voice was terrible. But then, any noise had felt like an ice pick in her ear. He seemed to sense her discomfort. He smiled at Lydia. He leaned over and turned down the radio. And then he put his hand on her knee. "Mom?" Lydia looked over at her daughter. She feigned a double take.
"I'm sorry. Are you Dee? I didn't recognize you without a phone in front of your face."
Dee rolled her eyes.
"You're not coming to my game because we suck, right? Not because you're still mad about the permission slip?"
Lydia felt awful that her daughter could even think such a thing.
"Honey, it's all about your poor performance. You're just too painful to watch."
"Okay, as long as you're sure."
"Positive. You are terrible."
"Question answered," Dee said. "But since we're being brutally honest, I have something else to tell you."
Lydia couldn't handle one more piece of bad news. She stared at the road, thinking, pregnant, failing biology, gambling debts, meth habit, genital warts. Dee said,
"I don't want to be a doctor anymore." Lydia felt her heart seize. Doctors had money. They had job security. They had 401ks and health insurance. You don't have to decide anything right now.
But I kind of do because of the undergrad of it all.
Dee slid her phone into her pocket. This was serious.
I don't want you to freak out or anything.
Lydia started to freak out. Sheep herder, farmer, actress, exotic dancer.
I was thinking I want to be a veterinarian.
Lydia burst into tears.
Jesus Christ,
Dee mumbled. Lydia looked out the side window. She had been fighting tears off and on all day, but this time she wasn't upset.
My dad was a vet. I wanted to be a vet, but...
She let her voice trail off. Because that's what you did when you were reminding your daughter that a felony drug conviction prevented you from being licensed in any state.
I'm proud of you, Dee. You'll be a great vet. You're so good with animals.
Thanks. Dee waited for Lydia to blow her nose.
Also, when I go to college, I want to start using my real name.
Lydia had been expecting this, but she still felt sad. Dee was making a new start. She wanted a new name to go with it. She told her, I went by the name Pepper until I changed high schools.
Pepper? Dee laughed. Like, salt and pepper?
I wish. My dad said it came from my grandmother. The first time she looked after me, she said, that child has hell and pepper in her hair. Lydia saw this required further explanation.
I was a handful when I was a kid.
Wow, you've really changed a lot. Lydia poked her in the ribs.
Julia's the one who started calling me Pepper.
Your sister? Dee's head had turtled down her neck. Her voice sounded tentative.
It's okay to talk about her.
Lydia willed her lips to turn up into a smile because talking about Julia was always hard.
Is there anything you want to know?
Dee obviously wanted to know more than Lydia could tell her. But she asked,
do you think you'll ever find her?
I don't know, sweetheart. It was a long time ago. Lydia rested her head in her hand.
We didn't really have DNA back then, or 24-hour news cycles or the internet. One of the things they never found was her pager.
What's a pager?
It's like text messaging, but you can only leave a phone number.
That sounds stupid.
Well,
maybe it sounded stupid to someone who could hold a tiny computer with access to the entire world's knowledge in her hand.
You look like her. Did you know that?
Julia was beautiful. Dee sounded dubious.
Like, really beautiful.
You're really beautiful too, sweetheart.
Whatever.
Dee took out her phone, ending the conversation. She slowly sunk back into the posture automobile. Lydia watched the wipers valiantly battle the rain. She was crying again, but not the humiliating sobby cries that she'd been struggling against all morning. First, Paul Scott, and now Julia. Today was, apparently, her day to be overwhelmed by old memories. Though admittedly, Julia was never far from Lydia's mind. 24 years ago, Julia Carroll had been a 19-year-old freshman at the University of Georgia. She was studying journalism because, in 1991, there was still such a thing as having a career as a journalist. Julia had gone to a bar with a group of friends. No one remembered a particular man paying closer attention to her than the others, but there must have been at least one. Because that night at the bar was the last time anyone ever reported seeing Julia Carroll again. Ever. They'd never even found her body. This was why Lydia had raised a child who could change a flat tire in 3 minutes
and who knew that you never, ever let an abductor take you to a second location. Because Lydia had witnessed firsthand what can happen to teenage girls who are raised to think that the worst thing that can happen to them is they don't get asked to the prom.